This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Steph and Ray from the Cybersecurity Challenge.
Hi, my name's Steph Aldridge and I work for Cybersecurity Challenge. I look after their Cyber Centurion competition. I've been running that in the UK for 5 years now and I look after all things diversity.
My name is Ray McClelland. I also work with Steph at Cybersecurity Challenge UK. I run a number of projects for Cybersecurity Challenge, among them the university programme. I work on Cyber Discovery as well, which is a government programme to encourage people aged 12 to 18 into cybersecurity careers.
One of the challenges we have is starting that feed line very early in terms of getting people engaged, getting them doing things. You've done a lot with competitions over the last couple of years. Where are we? How many of them are continuing to proceed and what can we expect to see next year?
We started our schools programme about 4 years ago. Really what that was about going out to schools and trying to get some lesson plans put together. We've done all of that and you're right, the industry for a little while was aware that we needed to dig down a little deeper and get the kids interested earlier so that they were taking the right options at school for their GCSEs. But actually, because they couldn't employ them for another 5 to 6 years, it was a little bit tougher than they gave it real thought for. So they still went after the graduates for quite a while.
Yes, that's right. Our university programme has been running for about the same amount of time now, based on that demand there that our sponsor base and the industry, wider industry, are looking for young people to employ. Not just young people, of course, but particularly those studying cybersecurity or related degrees. A number of our programmes include sponsor engagement or the competitions are designed by industry, so they're particularly relevant for those skills shortages that they have.
One of the obsessions seems to be with part of this industry that people must have a degree. If I look around a lot of council estates, a lot of schools, I see kids out there who've hacked their Xbox, they've hacked PlayStations. They have more skills than people are going to have by the time they finish a degree, but we don't seem to be able to connect with them. School seems to be at least a start point before they begin to go off the rails.
It is. One of the things I've noticed, and I was an outsider of cyber when I landed at Cybersecurity Challenge, so I had access, thanks to the challenge, to speak to all of the professional bodies and engage with them and ask them the sorts of questions that working class kids who went to a secondary school and then college and then tried, well, I just went straight into a job. I didn't do university. And was asking them the sorts of questions based on my background and knowledge set at the time. And they couldn't always give me an answer that I understood. And I remember thinking to myself, I know I'm asking the right kinds of questions. And if I can't understand what you're telling me, then maybe this is one of the issues around the language piece. A lot of the schools that come through our school's program are usually grammar, private, independent. And I think the reason why we're able to saturate that market is because teachers still have some scope, some right of exercise, some passion for the role that they have, and they've got some autonomy in the role. It's much harder to get to where we think, or at least I think anyway, the crux of diversity actually is, which is in your average state school, for want of a better word. Those teachers aren't always coming forward, and I think it's because they're maxed out.
Something I'd like to pick up on there, something that you asked, Ian, in particular about needing a degree, degrees in cybersecurity. The industry is largely built up of people who've transitioned over, especially those in managerial positions in cybersecurity. I know it's in the news a lot at the moment, but it's only really been around in the last kind of 5 to 10 years. Of course, information assurance has been around a lot longer, and of course, at a higher level, it's been around for many, many years. However, most people working in the industry have transferred across, and it's only recently that we've got people who are actually studying cybersecurity, computer science, forensics, and related disciplines coming through and filling those careers.
We tried to engage with the networks, or at least we are aware of the networks that are dealing with teachers in schools who want to do better around the computer science piece, who are based at state schools. So you've got groups like Computing at School, the CAS network, that's massive, it's brilliant. They've developed a set of their own resources for state schools. One of the things we tried to do with CAS and the wider group is to go out to AQA and some of the examination boards and find out which of them had to produce a computer science GCSE, which came out 2 years ago. We engaged with them, and alongside BT and some of their apprentices, we developed a set of lesson plans that covered off all of the new computer science GCSE so that teachers didn't have to feel scared. AQA came to us and said, once we've developed this, how do we get our market base, which are teachers in schools, to buy this particular GCSE rather than just go maths or avoid it altogether? And that's how we try to help, actually, by getting the industry galvanised to develop some lesson plans.
But you've also widened that. You've gone after youth organisations, scouts, guides, army cadets, air cadets, combined services, things like this. You've given yourself a wider spread, and those actually have become quite diverse organisations. How well has that engagement gone?
It's funny, isn't it? When you start looking at a network and you think to yourself, right, I'm going to phone them up. They must really want a piece of what Cybersecurity Challenge is doing. And actually, it's always more difficult than you give it credit for. So we phoned the Girl Guides and they said regionally, each group is autonomous and they can develop their own badges and they can do what they like. And actually, we're set now, thanks, for the next 5 years. We've got our sponsors and this is our STEM program. So we can't engage with them on a national basis for another couple of years. Cyber Centurion, I think, is the piece you're alluding to around the cadets and the Girl Guides. So Cyber Centurion is a competition for 12 to 18-year-olds. Because it was built by the Air Force Association in the States, that's a really good opening line to get the cadets involved in the UK. For me, that would be the first selling point. This is why you should get engaged, because this is originally an Air Force Association piece. And through that, like you've said, we've been able to reach out to different groups.
How would you take that one further? I'm engaged, for example, coaching at a number of sports clubs. And one of the things that's evident is that these clubs have a massive engagement with their junior sections. In their close season, they want to continue that engagement. They're trying to look at the close season and create new competitions. Is there a possibility of reaching out through those bodies and saying, look, here's something else you can add in? And it kind of fills that hole that the old youth clubs used to have.
One of the bigger issues around Girl Guides and the Scouts is that actually they're usually huts with outside space. They don't have access to internet. They don't have technology, and that stuff costs. Whereas the cadets and places like that are usually a bit more geared up for the technology piece based on where they could end up within any of the forces. That's been a more successful transition for us to get into. I understand what you mean about the grassroots piece. How do you grow that for that and keep the talent moving up the pipeline till they're in an Olympic arena? Historically, that's really what Cybersecurity Challenge has done really well. You can play an online competition, you can be invited to a face-to-face competition, and then find yourself at a masterclass. And once you're at face-to-face or masterclass, you can meet sponsors. And because most of the industry are sponsors of ours, you'll find them in rooms meeting people who've come through an online piece, a face-to-face piece, and they're like, okay, so you've got a real skill set. So historically, Cybersecurity Challenge has been able to help people bypass natural barriers to getting into cybersecurity, especially as career changers. When you start to look at HR processes, when you start to look at what kind of clearance do you need to be in that role, what is HR looking for? It usually looks for what the department already looks like, which is all male and highly technical. They might not understand the exact remit. So I think a lot of HR gets passed over to hiring managers. Mm-hmm. People running the cyber departments become the hiring managers for their own departments.
So how do you break into that from the diversity perspective? Because if we always employ the people we've always employed, you never change anything.
I can't answer all of the questions around that piece. And I think what you have to do, and again, I think the challenge has been really good at, once we started having masterclasses in London, the press could leave their afternoon on a Friday and say, I'll pop along to the thing that Cybersecurity Challenge are doing. And at that point, they can engage with people like the NCSC, the National Crime Agency, and have conversations with their female management and say, what kind of roles are you looking for? And at that point, you've had in the past, it was GCHQ and NCA and PwC and banks saying, well, actually, what's happening in the background is this. This is the storyline. It very well matches the real world scenarios that we deal with on a day-to-day basis. And we'd quite like to talk about the skill sets that some of the people in this room, this is what we're looking for. The industry wasn't doing that before Cybersecurity Challenge came along. It wasn't talking about what it needed, what were the skills base. And I think the more progressive companies are looking for kind of skill-based competencies rather than just the degree.
That's a really useful segue, because when we think about where do we get people from and how do we get them there, once we accept that the degree is a long-term goal, we have apprenticeships, we have vocational training. We have problems with apprenticeships and vocational training in this country because of the way we've shifted education over the last two decades. How do we get cybersecurity on the agenda as a vocational subject? Whether that be with an apprenticeship or without, at the very least, it gives people something they can take into a job.
What a lot of the bigger companies struggle with is that if you've got an apprentice on site, he or she isn't part of an actual program that's been developed, and there's a duty of care and all of that that's being taken care of by somebody else. Even then, it's how much can we allow that young person access to that has got security and privilege pieces to it. And there are some game changers out there who have developed their own internal programs whereby they are helping people get into the industry by creating a platform and building sandboxes that allow them to take their client issues into the sandbox area and allow younger people or people transitioning into the industry to have a go on that as a topic, as a problem, a real world problem that they can bring new ideas to. There are some people out there doing that kind of work.
Are we seeing people start with an apprenticeship and then go back to a university to finish something or to gain an additional qualification? Because some of the cybersecurity work at universities is about post-degree. So those who've done, let's say, a level 4 or higher apprenticeship have the opportunity to go back and top up skills.
I must say I haven't encountered very many, and I work a lot with university students, and maybe that is it. As you alluded to earlier, there certainly has been a shift in the last 10, 15 years towards university. So I think that apprenticeships are maybe not valued as highly. However, we're all advocates of apprenticeships, especially in this industry, such a fast-moving industry. I think apprenticeships are brilliant.
The levy was brought in 2 years ago, or maybe just last year, I can't remember now. Large companies like BT, PwC, Ernst & Young, all of those folks can have their own internal apprenticeship programs anyway, and they're really good apprenticeships. Again, they're accessing the super smart to be on those apprenticeships. If you're talking about how are we accessing the wealth of kids out of state schools, that becomes an area by area piece. It becomes a regional piece. What are each of the local councils doing? How do we push that? Because under a certain size, a company doesn't have to produce a 1%.
How do we engage a wider set of people from university? Because there's an assumption here that when we talk about cybersecurity, we're talking about the nerds, the people who've done comp sci. But the reality is that the attackers out there are just as easily engaging us through social media. We have a whole role here for people who've done human resources type degrees, psychologists, people like this, to give us an insight into why this attack succeeds, what is it they're actually after. And it doesn't yet seem to be a core part of most defence teams.
Absolutely. All of our university competitions are open to all university students, and in fact our competitions across the board. You certainly don't have to be from a cybersecurity background to understand the human elements of any kind of vulnerability or any kind of attack or any kind of threat to business. That's definitely something that we try and counter at the challenge.
And if you're talking about the criminal side of things, well, crime is organised. Crime is really organised and it's sharing its information, and the industry is just not quite there yet, is it? I think that's one of the scenarios or the differences between the not good, the black and white hat. How are we sharing? Are the banks sharing yet? And I think slowly, slowly those platforms are being built, and it has to be built on trust, and everybody has to be brought to the table and agree each inch of the step that they're making towards that sharing piece. Not so difficult for the criminals. because actually they're sharing all the information from the data breaches and the how-to and that kind of thing. The industry's doing its best, pretty sure of that.
We saw on the recent face-to-faces set by the NCA, and the focus on that was the forensic side, and from that comes the legal side. One of the challenges of bringing prosecutions is actually a lot of people in IT departments, when they're dealing with an incident, aren't forensically trained, they don't understand. There seems to be a big gap there in saying to people, it's not just about restoring those computers or kicking that hacker out, it's how do you do that in such a way that actually we can bring them to account. Are you seeing interest outside of things like the face-to-face competitions from people saying to you, why isn't there more forensics covered in this? Why don't you have a portion of it where if I'm somebody going through my training as a lawyer, I could come and apply and do some of this myself?
We've presented it a whole bunch of forums and thought leadership type networks. There's where you find the legal teams and those. And they have come to us and said, oh, we'd really love to run a desktop exercise in Cyber Awareness Month of October. Is that something you could help us with? And for us, quite often, it's about bandwidth. As a team, we don't have everything that everybody needs. We'd love to do more of that kind of stuff. You can get into the what is cybersecurity challenge doing for the whole of the cyber industry. My understanding is that we're in our third generation of pen testers. The criminals that existed 20 and 30 years ago were probably less organized but highly technical. And what you have now is a lot of pre-packaged naughty goods that script kiddies can just buy off the shelf. Yeah, you don't need to be a genius to be doing the basic stuff. What you end up with is there's two tiers out there. So there's a lot of bad stuff happening, but who are the baddies? And quite often it's just kids playing with stuff that they didn't make. They didn't create the code.
There's two things I wanted to pick up on there. What you were saying about what we offer for people who maybe aren't technical and for people coming from multidisciplinary backgrounds, we have actually had great success running non-technical development camps for people, and we certainly intend to do more of that in the future. The issue is, linked to what Steph was saying, it's really difficult to find those people. My inbox is relatively full of people saying, oh, do you do a non-technical thing? But then bringing them all together from across the whole of the UK for one event in one location is quite difficult, and we are a very small team and we certainly want to do more of that kind of thing. But then what do you focus on? Do you focus on social engineering? Do you focus on psychology? Do you focus on law or law enforcement? There are so many multifaceted things. It's generally a very interesting subject and people are keen to transition across, but there is an assumption that you'd have to be technically minded. And I think quite a lot of people, whether or not it's true, and Steph and I think are included in this, there's somewhat of an inferiority complex around not being a techie. Oh, I'm not a techie, I don't want to touch that. But quite often the industry is made up of people who aren't technical.
I understand just enough to push the conversation along. We're talking about diversity and opening up new markets or doing something new. One of the things Cybersecurity Challenge is doing is we have focused on neurodivergent thinking. I listened to a great podcast by Steve Silberman, bought his book Neurotribes, got a third of the way through it, and I was sold. I mean, the idea that people who are on the spectrum are probably already in the industry and there's lots of children being diagnosed at the moment, these sort of jumping out of school points where there's a high number of these children not in school and then being disregarded in a social way, they're not integrated properly, and it's that group that are more likely to find themselves isolated doing some really top skilled work just because they've got a capability. The industry for the last couple of years has started to look at that, and I know that there are people building neurodiversity programs. We ran the first neurodiversity event last year. We ran it at Shrivenham. We had about 40 students turn up. Once the autism specialist networks had got hold of the fact that we were running this event, I had phone calls from parents and teachers saying, he's not really a student because he's 23, 24. I had people who said, look, I was diagnosed a couple of months ago. I was diagnosed 5 years. All of that, and the amount of people that came out that wanted to see what was on offer was amazing, and we had a couple of young chaps who were 13 and 14 who managed to turn a 30-minute activity, which was a pen test activity, reduce it to a 120-second activity. And we ran a business track too, because actually business who want to get more people into the industry and are thinking about autism or neurodivergent as a group to go after, what is it? What does it mean? What does that mean? So we ran a business track. We had recruiters who had grown up with autism, who went on to have their own autistic children, who could really see where the gaps in the market were because of the work and the job that they had, and really fill those gaps with the skill sets that they understand if you know how to run the right kind of interview process, if you can run the right pre-interview process and get the people in the room, and what a neurodiversity program would look like for a company.
I was fortunate enough to talk to Emily Switek at that event. As a sports coach, something she said actually sat well with me, and that was, you can't say to somebody, I want the best you can do and I want it by Friday. Sometimes you have to rethink how you word things. And it made me think, how many people inside organisations who claim to work in these teams actually understand how to deal with their work colleagues? And I think it's something that as an industry we're very bad at. So how do we adapt to this industry to understand those conflicting goals to be that diverse industry?
It's a tech piece. It's across the tech industry. I've got friends with autistic children who don't have tech skills. They can look at your face and create a model of clay out of it by just spending a few moments with you. So their ability to be super visual and to remember, their memory capacity is amazing. What came out of last year's event was that the industry is really hungry for this. The people who engaged and have stayed in contact with me have a personal reason for staying engaged and getting more companies to think about running a neuro program internally and really doing stuff at grassroots. So we're running a second event. Last year, a consortium grew up out of the ashes, let's say, of the first neurodiversity event called the Cyber Neurodiversity Group. It's been founded by a chap called Mike Spain of Tech UK. He's seconded there for the Cyber Growth Partnership. And actually, the meetings that we've had for this group, that consortium, is really well attended. We have been given somebody from GCHQ as secretariat. So there's real support for this. We're running a second event this year at another MOD site up at Manchester, MOD Swinnerton. It's a training camp. This year, we're going to look at those HR processes. We'd really love to get some HR people, recruitment people, hiring managers, companies who want to understand more. I don't think this needs to be a cyber-specific piece. I think we can really open this up to anybody in a STEM-based industry. And we're going to look at those processes that are already being adopted by some of the larger companies who are going to talk about what good looks like. We're going to talk to the NCA and Cybersecurity Challenge, my colleague Debbie, who have been running intervention days for kids who are getting cease and desists, because I don't know about you, but when I was a teenager, I was doing all sorts of things I wasn't allowed to do, but it wasn't necessarily illegal. A lot of the Computer Misuse Act piece that these kids are accessing and can do, feel in their hearts, well, I did it because I could. Surely if you're not allowed to, there'd be somebody standing at the gate or a thing standing at the gate that wouldn't allow me access. And there can be confusion around those. We'll have NCA in the house talking about the kinds of people that they end up speaking to when they go to cease and desist. And we've been running intervention days to highlight the industry to those children because of their skill sets, and to the parents to say, actually, there's a whole industry out here. If you'd really like to engage with us, we can help you and your kids.
There's an irony here, isn't there? Because we tell kids to look for role models. And when you look at a lot of television today, we've seen the glorification of hackers in particular. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., the Marvel program, is a very good example of that. Here you have a major character whose skill set is that she can hack. It was clever because they broke boundaries, they did things you wouldn't expect. But now you've glorified the role, but you haven't glorified the role in such a way as to deal with the grey lines. How do we approach those grey line problems?
It certainly was the case, and it's something we're trying to move away from in the industry, that those bad boys, and unfortunately they were all boys, in the early days of the internet, who got caught breaking into banks or doing something really, really bad, they did get star-studded jobs at the end of it. So you can see why certain young people might think, oh, if I get caught breaking into the Bank of England, I'm going to get a 500 grand a year job. But that is really not the case. As Steph was saying earlier, we've been working a lot with the National Crime Agency and also regional police forces.
We've been working a lot with their outreach because they're dealing a lot with their grassroots regional schools, their kids. They've got the same accents as those children. We've been building some event days for them and getting local cyber companies in the room, again, similar accents, so that the children see and hear themselves in their region, in their location.
Yes, and those intervention days in particular, they're particularly valuable because reaching those young people who've maybe committed a small offence, or they're at least on the radar of their local police or their school, who have then spoken to the police about them. It's really important to get hold of those people at those formative years, because quite often the boundaries are very blurred when it comes to ethics, when the consequences are so far removed that you don't fully realise, especially at that young age when your own moral compass is not quite formed yet. Working with people like Cybersecurity Challenge, your local police force and the big boys, the National Crime Agency, and working with the young people and their parents, that's really valuable.
But there's a deeper problem here, isn't it? It's how we describe it. We tend to talk about white-collar crime, as if white-collar crime doesn't actually have a victim. And the phrase victimless crime has often been used with related to a lot of cyber incidents. When we look at hijacking a car or robbing somebody in the street or burglary, these people have immediate consequences. They know what they've done. When it comes to stealing money from a bank or whatever, bank robbers have always been glorified as heroes, the little man taking on the big organization. How do we change that without destroying the excitement for some of these people in what they're doing? Because that excitement is what we want them to bring to the job, surely.
One of the unique selling points about Cybersecurity Challenge is that we put games on a website, and we don't care how old you are. If you can get through those, what we would call a virtual game, you're having loads of fun. I have met grown-ups who are Czech team leaders. They've been through the best of Ian Glover's Crest's processes and professional certifications, and they're like, yeah, we ended up being managers, but we really like pen testing. It's hacking. That's the bottom line. It's about, are you allowed to do that? Are you enjoying the job of doing that? All of that stuff. And lots of pen testers didn't want to grow up and become managers after being in the role for 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years. They wanted to keep doing. So actually, cybersecurity is always exciting because it changes, and that has to be something that we talk about more often for both male and females. It's a very exciting industry. It's a broad church. I think cybersecurity is a little bit like the Women's Equality Party. It exists now so that it doesn't exist in the future. Cybersecurity has to become a thought process. Slips, trips and falls, crossing the road, looking both ways. Yeah, seatbelts. It has to become something that's part of our everyday life. What are you doing online? Why are you doing that online? And who else can see it? And do you want them to be able to access it? What that means for people trying to get into the industry or doing stuff that they shouldn't because they're too young and the lines are blurred is actually the NCA do not want to criminalise kids. They don't. It's sad. It's a huge waste of Home Office money. So they are, again, looking into their judicial procedures. I'm not aware of the details of that, but to criminalise 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17-year-old for something that they maybe weren't really sure about, and even if they were, actually, what you've got is a skill set. There's a reason why they're doing it, and that's because they're not aware that there's an industry desperate for their skill set where there's lots of money to be made.
Let me come back full circle to where we started. There might be an industry desperate for that skill set, but is that industry really willing to take them on if they don't have qualifications and certifications? I would quite frankly happily take a 15, 16, 17-year-old who shows me they can hack an Xbox, shows me they can hack a PlayStation, shows me they know how to get hold of these tools and use them, than somebody who's sat there and done some paper exercises and got a qualification. Because these people have a feel. They know how to solve a problem. They know how to do this stuff. I can round out their education, happily send them to night school, find some other way to engage them in that. Yeah. But teaching them those innate skills is incredibly hard. Yeah.
We have that time and time again from our sponsor community and the industry at large. You cannot learn from a book what it takes to be fastidious with a problem.
An inquisitive creative, that's born, isn't it?
An employer will always retrain you how they want, or they will pay for your master's or whatever it is that keeps you in that organisation, because they want you for your skill set and your aptitude.
The point you were trying to make is that where's the time and energy to take on people who are showing a skill set but maybe don't have all the other... If you're a hiring manager or you are running a cyber department in any company of any size in this country, you're exhausted. Whenever you train somebody up, they leave to get the next job that's going to access them more money. What I'd say about the ladies, by the way, is that you could train them up and they'd be less likely to leave, especially if they felt there was still a job to complete. So women can be way more loyal than boys in that sense. I don't want to make parallels, but that's one of the differences, I think, about boys and girls, or males, females, that women like to build community. A lot of the women that you find in the industry, mapped across from finance or the social sciences, like Ray was saying earlier, HR, and there's a higher number of women mapping into the governance roles within cybersecurity, because governance is about, why are you doing that like that? And women are really good at sitting down with people, finding out why you think the way you think, and maybe helping that employee do a little bit more securely, smarter, and help somebody get to a space where actually they're now conforming to the governance piece, which is the ethos of the company. And they're enjoying that because they're building community and they're building relationships. And that's something women are good at.
On that issue of drive, are you seeing much of a dividend from the number of veterans who are now starting to be attracted to the industry? Because, of course, they, by their very nature, their training, are about completion.
And they have a security map in their heads. It may be a physical map they'd like to be looking at, but actually the terrain changes. The map stays the same, but the terrain changes. I don't know what the numbers are around that. I know Tony, who works for Security Cleared, has been dealing with ex-forces for a very long time with their SC clearances or the DV clearances, and they can go straight into security-based roles. About 4 or 5 years ago, he approached Cybersecurity Challenge and was like, actually, we're doing all of these security cleared kinds of jobs. We should really be thinking about cyber. We've been supporting him for a long time. And it's another area, I think, AWS run forces into security as part of their charitables. It's around people running corporate social responsibility. It's what are we doing for ex-forces? It becomes a stream as opposed to an internal inclusive program.
I think it's been around for a little while. Coming from a defence cyber background myself, the amount of people with the skill set required for cybersecurity. And of course, when you're leaving the forces, there are various programmes to kind of get you repatriated. I don't know if that's the word, you know, release you back into the wild, into Civvy Street. And you come away with your credits to come and retrain. And I think there is greater awareness upon leaving of things like this. I've seen a couple of people walking around here today at Recoded who are ex-services or indeed still in the services. And they find themselves coming to these kind of events to just kind of play the field. I don't know if that's appropriate, but they really do want to have some face time with employers to get that positive affirmation that their skills are relevant in the outside world, and they so often are. I'm talking on a panel tomorrow with a young guy who was in the RAF for 6 years, and because of personal circumstances he left, he became a father, and he's now at university and he's started the computer society at his university. He's an ambassador with us. One of the things that he's talking about in the panel is perseverance. And that if you put yourself out there and you try as many interviews or you meet as many people, you will find a role that fits you and your skills, because the industry is so diverse, it is so varied, and there are so many skills that are required. And he's a great advocate of exactly, back to your question, is that kind of mentality that comes out of being in the services, but then making it work in civilian life, but also in our industry, which is kind of complementary to both things.
Steph and Ray, it's been a great conversation. Thank you both for your time today.
Thanks for all the questions. Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
Yes, thanks.